This is IRIB English Radio.
The headlines: Iran's top negotiator says he will hold, quote, result-oriented talks with the EU coordinator in Brussels to discuss the removal of illegal US sanctions. Sudan's main opposition coalition calls for a peaceful escalation against the coup after 7 people were killed and 140 others injured during protests. Also in the headlines, gunmen kill at least 18 people and injure 20 others at a mosque in Niger State in northern Nigeria. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran says it's determined to engage in talks aimed at the removal of US sanctions in effective and verifiable ways. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs, Ali Bagheri Kani, said he'll meet the EU coordinator of the Joint Commission on the 2015 nuclear deal in Brussels on Wednesday. He said Iran is ready to continue, quote, results-oriented negotiations. The Iranian diplomat said it's now up to the other signatories to the international accord to move forward with regards to their commitments. Bagheri noted that the continuation of the so-called maximum pressure campaign won't help overcome challenges in the upcoming talks in Vienna. Iran and the remaining signatories have held 6 rounds of talks in the Austrian capital since April to remove US sanctions. Iran has slammed a new UN report on the human rights situation in the country, saying the sole purpose of such reports is to use them as a tool against other nations. Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN reacted harshly to the report prepared by the UN Special Rapporteur on the Islamic Republic. Zahra Irshadi underlined that the rapporteur has once again used information provided by terrorist groups on the human rights situation in Iran. She noted that the report has taken a selective approach to Iran's human rights achievements. Irshadi said dialogue and cooperation based on mutual respect are the only tools available to ensure the promotion and protection of human rights at the international level. She stressed that Tehran, despite the new report, would continue its constructive cooperation with UN human rights mechanisms. Political commentator Alexander Azadegan calls the UN Special Rapporteur's report on human rights situation in Iran highly politicized.
There are several things taking place in the background. Frankly, I'm disappointed that it is very pathetic to have to go through the UN route and appoint this person as a rapporteur, because usually they try to weasel their way through Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch, and we all know a lot of these organizations are highly compromised, and by that I'm talking about them being highly politicized. The reason they're going through the UN, in my opinion, is that they want to cast a negative shadow on Iran at a very sensitive talk when it comes to the nuclear negotiations, the so-called negotiations. I don't know what they're going to negotiate on anymore. So they're trying to sort of muddy the water from that perspective. And what you mentioned, an actual terrorist group giving feedback or giving information to this rapporteur or any other organization for matter, is quite disgusting. This particular terrorist group, I'm assuming it would be the MKO, are loathed in Iran, and not just in Iran, but also in Iraq. There were Saddam Hussein's mercenary in the 1990s, killing Shia, killing Kurds, anybody who stood up to Saddam Hussein.
Sudan's main opposition coalition has called for a peaceful escalation against a military takeover in the country. The alliance, known as Forces of Freedom and change demanded nationwide protests and civil disobedience against the military's move. Earlier, in a televised speech, the ruling council head, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, declared a state of emergency and announced the dissolution of the transitional government. He, however, vowed to form what he called a competent government and pledged a transition to a civilian state. But the information ministry described the move as a coup. According to the ministry, Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok had been detained and moved to an unknown location. Meanwhile, demonstrators hit the streets of the several cities to decry the military takeover of the country. Protesters in the capital Khartoum and the most populated city of Omdurman chanted slogans against military rule and burned tires. Health officials say 7 people were killed and 140 others were injured in clashes between protesters and military forces. Sudan has been ruled by an interim government since the ouster of longtime President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. However, tensions have been running high between civilian and military leaders since a failed coup attempt in September. Political commentator John Philpott says any government in Sudan should change the country's policy on ties with Israel.
We have seen the so-called democracy movement, and which appears to be pro-Western. They recognized Israel. They turned over Mr. al-Bashir to the ICC, which is unthinkable. The ICC only has accused Africans up to now, and it's clearly a pro-Western court. So right now, it looks to me like the people in the government of the power in the Sudan is not happy with the pro-Israeli Zionist colonialist approach, and they want to rectify the wrongs done politically in the orientation of their government. I must say, a lot of us don't like coups. It's not something which we admire, but we notice the hypocrisy because the U.S. did not condemn the coup in Guinea. So they have no standing, in my opinion. My reading of this, and I say that very humbly, I see it as a reaction to the pro-Western turn in the Sudan.
Meanwhile, reactions are pouring in following the military coup in Sudan, with governments and world bodies expressing concern about the developments in the African nation. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres denounced the coup and called for the immediate release of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and other detained officials. The UN Special Representative for Sudan also slammed the detentions as unlawful. The European Union's Foreign Policy Chief expressed concern over the situation. Josep Borrell called on all stakeholders and regional partners to put the transition process back on track. French President Emmanuel Macron also condemned the coup and urged the Sudanese authorities to release all the detainees. In Britain, Africa Minister Vicky Ford censured the coup as an unacceptable betrayal of the Sudanese people. An armed attack on a mosque in northern Nigeria has left at least 18 worshippers dead and 20 others injured. The attack took place in the Machigu region of the country's largest state of Nigeria. Locals say the gunmen on motorbikes arrived at the mosque and indiscriminately shot at worshippers offering morning prayers. More than 10 people were also reportedly abducted. There's no official comment on the incident, but armed bandits have kidnapped or killed hundreds across northwestern Nigeria this year. They recently attacked a village market in Sokoto State, killing at least 40 people. The Boko Haram terrorist group is also operating in the region and is said to be recruiting villagers to fight the government. The Syrian Foreign Ministry has confirmed fresh Israeli airstrikes near its southern border, saying the country reserves the right to respond to these attacks. Syrian media quoted an official from the ministry as describing the strikes as a desperate attempt in support of the terrorist groups in the region. The official slammed the attack as Israel's latest act of aggression against Syria and a violation of the country's sovereignty. The strikes reportedly targeted Syrian military positions in the country's south in the early hours of Monday. The Israeli regime frequently carries out airstrikes inside Syria, despite the country's repeated calls for action from the United Nations. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military as well as resistance forces battling foreign-backed terrorists. Bahrain's main opposition group says a former prisoner has died from medical complications he developed while languishing in the regime's jail. The Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society said Ali Qambar died after losing his battle with cancer. It said he had developed cancer as a result of deliberate medical negligence and various forms of torture in the prison. The regime's forces arrested Qambar in 2012 for his political activism. He stood trial and was sentenced to prison on some trumped-up charges. He was released in 2018 when his health condition worsened severely. The Bahraini regime has time and again denounced by rights groups and organizations over prison conditions and abuse against detainees. Moving on, Ronald Lumumba is the son of the first Prime Minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba. He says the model of democracy being promoted in Africa only aims to protect the interests of Western powers.
De soi-disant de protection de la démocratie et les droits de l'homme au Congo.
Ronald Lumumba said until a better model is developed in Africa, the current model needs to be corrected so it adapts to the reality on the ground. He also accused Western powers of causing insecurity in the Congo in order to exploit the African country's natural resources. Lumumba said the West has waged the war on the Congolese people by backing militias. Patrice Lumumba served as Congolese Prime Minister from June until September 1960. He was killed by Belgian-backed forces in January 1961. In 2002, Brussels formally apologized for its role in the assassination. Petrol prices in the UK have hit a record high in yet another blow to households and businesses already facing shortages across the country. The average daily price reached over $2 a litre on Sunday, beating the former record set in April 2012. The rise comes as global oil prices continue to rise, doubling from around $40 a barrel a year ago to $85 now. Another contributing factor to the UK price hike is the country switching over to E10, petrol that contains less carbon and more ethanol, making it more expensive. In addition, some retailers have raised the amount to the level prior to the coronavirus pandemic. The country has also been dealing with fuel shortages at its filling stations, sparked by a lack of truckers. Iran has hosted the 14th Iranian Folk Music Festival in the city of Kerman. The annual event seeks to introduce Iranian folklore music, which is one of the most diverse in light of the country's ethnic diversity. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Iran is a land of ethnic diversity, and that is reflected in different languages, cultures, and of course, music. After over a one-year hiatus due to the coronavirus, the Iranian Folk Music Festival has once again hosted musicians from across Iran, each playing their local tunes using their indigenous instruments.
I come from the northern Khorasan province. I am so happy to be part of this music festival to share my city's music with my fellow Iranians from other cities. I've brought our local instruments, such as sonar, which is an ancient Iranian woodwind instrument, and dhol, which is a local type of drum.
We in Sistan and Baluchistan province play sitar, which we also call tambure. We also play qaychak, which is a type of a bowed lute, similar to kamanche. We usually play in celebrations.
Every night during the three-day festival, different local ensembles took to the stage to perform, so the audience could listen to Kurdish, Baluchi, Azeri, and Arabic tunes in a matter of a few hours. And this is my favorite part. On the sidelines of the festival, bands from different ethnicities get together and improvise. This is where music transcends languages and interconnects various cultures.
Music is a language that needs no translation. We may not understand each other's languages, but as you could see, different people are interacting peacefully through music.
It's so interesting to see artists from different parts of the country perform together. This is the true meaning of national unity that binds us despite our cultural differences.
And organizers say that's the main purpose of holding such an event, to unite different ethnicities through the language of music.
Music is an integral part of society's identity and history, and Iran is no exception. So the festival tries to both introduce the local music of different ethnic groups in Iran while establishing peace and friendship among them.
Organizers also hope that the festival would help revive Iran's folk music, which has long been overshadowed by some of the heavily invested genres, like pop.
Through music, it's easier to grasp the ethnic diversity in Iran, because music itself is a language, a universal language that speaks the beauty of differences and peaceful coexistence of different cultures as one nation. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Kerman.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. From the perspective of international humanitarian law, The Hague and the Geneva Conventions, it is clear that drones are indiscriminate weapons and therefore illegal because they contravene the two core rules of international humanitarian law, the distinction between military and civilian targets and the principle of proportionality. We now present you an article written jointly by Alfred de Zayas and Adriel Casunta. The piece is titled U.S. Drone Strikes, Errors, and the Cost in Human Life. The article has been published by the Asia Times. Please stay with us for more of Alfred de Zayas and Adriel Casunta's article. According to the initial reporting from U.S. officials, the 29th of August drone strike aimed at annihilating members of the terrorist group Daesh was described as a successful operation that destroyed a car filled with multiple suicide bombers, posing an imminent threat to U.S. occupation troops leaving Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover. The celebratory mood did not last long, though, as witness reports that emerged shortly after the incident in Kabul's Khawaja Burga neighborhood debunked the Pentagon's narrative by exposing the ugly truth. The casualties were not terrorist savages, but 10 innocent members of the Ahmadi family, including 7 children. After photographs showing victims right before their deaths had emerged and actual footage of their horror began circulating on social media, it became clear that the youngest victims were just 2 years old. Another one killed in the airstrike was a 36-year-old former Afghan serviceman, an employee of the charity organization Nutrition and Education International, identified as Zamarai Ahmadi. Although, because of the public pressure, the Pentagon was later forced to admit that the assassination of these civilians was a tragic mistake, and ex gratia condolence payments to the Ahmadi family have been raised during a recent online meeting between Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Carl and the founder and president of Nutrition and Education International, Dr. Stephen Wan. The accountability for similar actions remains the great unknown. According to Amal Ahmadi's 22-year-old nephew, Farshad Haydari, as of 18th of September, the United States had made no direct contact with the family of the victims. Farshad Haydari told Agence France-Presse news agency, "They must come here and apologize to us face to face." Furthermore, despite U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's recent assertions that the Pentagon will endeavor to learn from this horrible mistake, there is little hope that this is the case, bearing in mind that the similar incidents concerning killing large numbers of civilians in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria had already taken place in the past. According to numerous reports by the New York Times and the Reuters news agency and other media. As Nick McDonnell, author of a 2018 book titled The Bodies in Person, An Account of Civilian Casualties in American Wars, argues, in fact, the U.S. military has repeatedly suppressed information on civilian casualties. Nick McDonnell says the drone program is opaque, with extremely limited accountability for anyone involved. Bearing in mind that most of the U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan have taken place in rural areas, and the fact that there is a direct correlation between the intensity of airstrikes and the cries in the investigation of civilian deaths in their result, there is little hope for meaningful justice for the victims, apart from this isolated case. Public outrage depends on the attention that the mainstream media will pay to drone killings. From the perspective of international humanitarian law, the Hague and Geneva Conventions, it is clear that drones are indiscriminate weapons and therefore illegal because they contravene the two core rules of international humanitarian law. The distinction between military and civilian targets and the principle of proportionality. Moreover, they entail serious violations of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which the United States and all NATO countries are bound to observe. It is worth noting that the concluding observations of the United Nations Human Rights Committee following the examination of the U.S. fourth period report in 2014 condemned targeted killings using unmanned aerial vehicles or drones as contrary to Article 6 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR. We can read in the document, the committee is concerned about the lack of transparency regarding the criteria for drone strikes, including the legal justification for specific attacks, and the lack of accountability for the loss of life resulting from such attacks. The document said, the committee remains concerned about the state party's very broad approach to the definition and geographical scope of armed conflict, including the end of hostilities, the unclear interpretation of what constitutes an imminent threat, who is a combatant or a civil or a civilian taking direct part in the hostilities, the unclear position on the nexus that should exist between any particular use of lethal force and any specific theater of hostilities, as well as the precautionary measures taken to avoid civilian casualties in practice. Similarly, in his 2010 report to the Human Rights Council, Professor Philip Alston denounced indiscriminate killings through drones and concluded that the rationale given for their use eviscerate the human rights law prohibition against the arbitrary deprivation of life. In addition, drone killing of anyone other than the target, family members or others in the vicinity, for example, would be an arbitrary deprivation of life under human rights law, and could result in state responsibility and individual criminal liability. In 2014, Ben Emmerson, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism, issued a damning report condemning the accountability vacuum for civilian killings by drones. As a United Nations independent expert on international order, one of the authors of this article agreed with Philip Alston and Ben Emmerson and decried the institutional impunity of the United States and North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, insisting that there is state responsibility, both civilian and penal, and an obligation by those states causing collateral damage to make reparations to the victims and their families. Unfortunately, although empirical evidence demonstrates the incompatibility of the use of drones with international law, the United States will continue ignoring the Human Rights Committee and a special rapporteur of the Human Rights Council because they lack enforcement mechanisms. It seems that drones will continue to be used with impunity until the international community agrees to exercise universal jurisdiction over war criminals, arrest them when they enter their jurisdiction, and thus vindicate the rights of the victims of such savagery. Above all else, the question remains, what is the right amount of money that can make up for the loss of innocent life? The mainstream media would be well advised to cease whitewashing these crimes, playing down the human cost of drones and disseminating disinformation about a supposed legal black hole. The priority must always be to provide immediate assistance, and not just money, to the victims, and ensure that the new prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, and expeditiously investigates these crimes.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Very welcome to the show, Viewpoints. So regarding the speeches of the leader of Iran on the concept of human being, and the we can say the most important speeches that the rahbar gave on the role that the human being might have in today's world, there have been a series of discussions, and we try to get into the different dimensions and angles of the life of the human beings. For today's discussion, we want to talk about human rights, and first of all, we have to define the rights. I mean, what are the rights for a human being? Let's start with whom, Sheikh Sadiq or Brother Ali? Sheikh Sadiq, let's start with you. What are these rights that the human is looking for?
I think a more appropriate place to start is the position of human.
Okay.
In both a materialistic, or let's say Western, worldview and a Tawhidi one. In a materialistic worldview, human is the center of the world. And being the center of the world, being the highest creature, means having all the privileges. You can do whatever you want because you're human. You can slaughter animals, you can use and abuse the environment, you can do whatever you want because you're human, you're the God. But in an Islamic worldview, in a Tawhidi worldview, human is still the highest creation, is the best of a creation. But it doesn't mean just having all the privileges. It's having the highest privileges, but also the highest responsibilities.
Sheikh Sadiq, again, this is the question. Okay, respecting for the human beings in general and being after the rights of the oppressed ones, okay? So I think in a previous program you said that 1% are ruling over the world and 99% are looked as the instruments. So it seems the play is very much difficult, brother. So how can this 1% look for the true rights of the human beings in the world, except getting to an absolute source of power,
which is the absolute power of the creator, of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I think in this play of this world, that 1% might not be successful unless doing that. Is it so?
Yeah. The human rights that is talked about in the West is actually the bare minimum. Right? It's just there to avoid the unhumane activities that happen, like the war crimes and stuff like that. Like the right to go to trial before being executed. Like that's the level of rights that we're talking about. The right to not be killed.
Yes.
These are the rights that we're talking about.
Okay.
And even this bare minimum is not practiced because of the hypocrisy that you talked about, and it's there. And they're basically giving the illusion of human rights, the illusion of having rights, the illusion of freedom and everything else to people just to keep them silent.
That's right.
And on the contrary, when you look at, for example, Risalatul Huquq by Imam Sajjad, it's not talking about the bare minimum. Mm-hmm. Like you have the right of your father, the things that if you talk about in the West, it's like you're doing your father a favor. It's not his right. But in Islam, that's his right. That's your mother's right.
Yes.
And even your body parts, like this is the right of your hand.
Oh,
this is the right of your feet.
Very good.
Even not even animals or environment or objects, even actions have rights. This is the right of your prayer.
Oh.
This is the right of your fast.
That's right.
This is the right of Hajj. This is the right of Zakat. Everything has rights.
Okay.
And like we're talking about a much, much higher standard when we talk about rights.
Yeah, and the look is really beautiful, you know, just dating back into more than 1,000 years ago, but it still could be available. And I think that we, I don't know, I don't want to judge again the Western system, but...
Oh, please do.
because...
Be my guest.
You know, but the case is that these rights that we are talking about nowadays, I think, is very much simplistic and
Hippocratic.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Hippocratic,
because
that's right.
They've been doing like slavery until
so many years.
Yeah, until very recently.
Yeah, 1950.
Or women's rights, whatever you look at.
Yeah.
They've been violating all these rights.
Yes.
They've been doing all these crimes.
Yes.
And now they're criticizing other parts of the world.
Still doing.
And they're trying to overcompensate for everything.
Overcompensating, that's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So we see this hypocrisy everywhere, and they don't even catch up to their claims.
That's all right. How is observing human rights possible? From one side, you're selling weapons to the Saudis to kill Yemenis, and from the other side, you are looking for a peace treaty between the two. How is it possible?
Yeah, I told you.
I mean, just look. From one side, the weapons industry, the military industry, is very much, financially speaking, boosting all around the world, okay?
That's the power of media, isn't it?
No, this is the real power, brother.
No, because, you have a huge list of violations.
Yes.
Like, where do I start?
Yeah, man.
Which part of it, like, just let's spin the globe and just pin somewhere and see your violations over there. Just pick somewhere randomly. And you have all these violations, and through your media, you portray yourself as a hero.
Yeah.
And then we have all these amazing realities here.
But again, out of the power of media, they hide these realities.
Exactly.
You see?
And portray the opposite.
Yeah. If you want to study, for example, about the human right in Islam, then when you check, I don't know, when you Google it, what will come up first?
Yeah.
The thing that they have fed. You see? Nothing about the... that's why the leader of the Islamic Ummah, in a letter to the youth of Europe...
But that's something we lack too, right?
Yeah. Ask them to
shout out here to anyone who is working on media.
Yeah.
Like, we need to work on it more.
Very
we need
true.
To, like,
yeah, we have to work
very,
on it. Yes,
very
we
seriously.
Have to our own planning, you know, our own models, you know.
When
we
have
to introduce
tell them that refer to the Islamic
original
resources,
sources,
original
right.
of the
original,
Islam,
yes.
to tell you what their human right is, then come and condemn us. but they don't let them to know what Islam says. For example, they introduced Saudi Arabia as a role model for the human rights.
Yes.
When no human right can be actually seen and interpreted there.
Yeah.
You see, this is again the power of media, to show themselves good, to hide the realities and beauties of Islam in human rights and in the definition of human rights. This is a power of media. I call it media empire.
Mediocracy we have nowadays.
Yeah. So you see, the Sheikh was actually pinpointed the right point, which is the power of media, which actually deviates everything and does not let, or do not let the people to reach and to find the realities of Islam. Thank you, Sheikh. Sorry for interruption.
Yeah, when I look at the situation with their media against ours, I remember the lecture of Imam Ali in the Battle of Siffin. He says to his soldiers that soldiers of Muawiyah are amazing at their battle.
At the kuf.
Yeah, their kuf.
Yes.
And you are so weak at your haqq.
Yeah, man.
Mm-hmm. I want to take one of them and give 10 of you.
Oh.
Right? So this is the same with our media.
They are
presenting their battle so good, and we have all these amazing things. We have haqiqa here, and we cannot present it. We don't have the power to present it. It's a very sad reality.
That's all right. And I think the absolute haqiqa is the hands of the imam of the age, the hujjah, you know?
Mm.
I think if the type of the haqiqa, the truth, he's going to show it to us, might crystallize our eyes to the very reality of the world, even for ourselves.
But bro, because it was at the hand of Imam Hussein as well. But
yeah, I know.
And if again through the power of media, Imam Hussein is not looked at as the way that I deserve to be seen.
Yes.
So again, the Imam will be sacrificed again.
That's right.
You see, we have to prepare ourselves. I mean, we have to again through the power of media, we have to strengthen the media that we need to have, because I believe. I have seen a hadith, a narration that said, the connotation of the hadith says that Imam will not emerge until your media is as strong as it is needed.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah. Media means that media, your word has been reached to the world to the extent that it was supposed to be.
Medium. That's
so
why.
It is very interesting that even media is something that actually paves the way for the emergence of Imam Mahdi.
That's right. Of course, this media tech does not mean the technical media now, there's radio and TV, but the medium, you mean
this
the
is
means.
The instrument
it could be
for
Arba'in,
reaching,
right?
Yeah,
a lot of people
anyway.
Talk about how Arba'in is introducing Imam Hussein, and when the Imam of our time reappears, he introduces himself as the grandson of Imam Hussein, because everyone in the world knows Imam Hussein. No one knows Imam Sadiq, for example, in America, but they've all heard of Imam Hussein alayhi salam through Arba'in pilgrimage.
That's all right. I hope that one day the rights of the human beings are observed in the true sense of the word, as regarding the true position of the human being in the world, the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. First, we have to understand this, give importance to the intellect of the human beings, and also the intellect that is under the shadow of divinity. You know, this is very important. Man-centrism and self-centrism must be forgotten, you know, if you want to have human rights observed in the true sense of the word, because anything you do will be according to your own personal decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the personal decisions, one day might be right, the other today might be wrong. So nowadays, see how many movements do we have in the world. Colored people, you know, different languages, minorities,
nationalities,
races, you know,
geography.
Look at the women and the men, you know, who are looking in some of the societies after the rights. And so today in the legal system, this law is issued and that law is issued, this law is rebutted and that law is denied, okay? So how many times and how many ways, you know, up to the end of the world, you're going to do reformation on the law system and you are getting nowhere, because the position of the human in this chart might be understood in a wrong way. So we have to get into the true definition of the human being, I think, and understand its true rights. Then I think the problems are solved. Thank you much, Sheikh Sadeq and Brother Ali, for presence in the program. Pleasure. Viewpoints.
Thanks to you, brother.
Beautiful discussion on the concept of human rights as tackled by the leader of Iran, by the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you much for listening to us. Visit our website at parstoday.com/EN. You can download for free our previous episodes on this program too. Also visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies. As I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
New figures released by Global Witness show that 227 people were killed in 2020 while trying to protect forests, rivers, and other ecosystems that their livelihoods depended on. We're prepared for you an article written by Jonathan Watts. The piece is titled Murders of Environment and Land Defenders Hit Record High. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Murders of environment and land defenders hit a record high last year as the violent resource grab in the global south continued unabated despite the coronavirus pandemic. New figures released by Global Witness show that 227 people were killed in 2020 while trying to protect forests, rivers, and other ecosystems that their livelihoods depended on. All but one of the deadly attacks took place outside North America, Europe, and Oceania. the authors say, environment-related conflict is, like the climate crisis, disproportionately affecting lower-income nations. Indigenous communities suffered more than a third of the killings, despite accounting for only 5% of the world's population. The report says, on average, our data shows that 4 defenders have been killed every week since the signing of the Paris Climate Agreement in 2016. The report added, as the climate crisis deepens, forest fires rampage across swathes of the planet, drought destroys farmland, and floods leave thousands of people dead, the situation for frontline communities and defenders of the earth is getting worse. The annual tally of the dead has risen for the past 2 years and is now twice the level of 2013. This is still thought to be an underestimate because the calculation depends on transparency, press freedom, and civil rights, which vary considerably from country to country. Chris Madden, one of the authors of the report, said, "The attacks are on the rise." He added, "We are seeing that in multiple data sets around the world. As in previous years, South and Central America, home of the world's richest biodiversity and intact forests, was the deadliest region for those trying to resist mining, logging, and agribusiness." Colombia topped the list with 65 deaths, continuing a murderous trend since the 2016 peace accord that eased conflict between the government and FARC separatists, but opened up swathes of the country to extractive industries and greater tension over resources. The victims include biologist Gonzalo Cardona, credited with saving the yellow-eared parrot from extinction. He was murdered by a criminal gang, and forest ranger Yamid Alonso Silva, who was killed near El Cocuy National Park. Such is the level of violence and intimidation that a 12-year-old boy, Francisco Vera, has received anonymous death threats on Twitter due to his activism. The second deadliest nation was Mexico, where 30 defenders of the environment lost their lives. Among them was Oscar A. Rode Adams, an indigenous man from the Cumayai territory in Mexico, who protested when his crops dried up after the community water resource was diverted to richer areas and a Heineken factory. He was gunned down on 24th of September in Tecate, Baja California, by assassins who arrived at his home in 2 vehicles with tinted windscreens. Third was the Philippines, with 29 deaths. The most shocking occurred on 30th of December, when the Philippines military and police slaughtered 9 Tumandok indigenous people who had been resisting a megadam project under Jalao River in Panay. Brazil was the next in the global ranking with 20 killings. Brazil's death toll has fallen slightly in recent years. Instead of small-scale illegal attacks on a local level, the assault on defenders of the environment now takes the form of bills and laws in Congress that undermine environmental and territorial protections. Co-author of the report, Rachel Cox, said, "In recent years in Brazil, we have seen policies for aggressive expansion. They are using legal mechanisms. It's a different kind of attack, criminalization, and the undermining of political rights of the defenders of the environment." The report also listed a case in Saudi Arabia. Abdulrahim Al-Huwaiti of the Huwaiti tribe was killed resisting eviction from a planned new city-state in Neom in Saudi Arabia. The COVID lockdown provided little respite for defenders of the environment, while opening up new territory to land grabbers and poachers. Chris Madden, one of the authors of the report, said 2020 was supposed to be the year the world stood still, but this didn't translate to less attacks. He added, in some countries, protests were shut down while industries were allowed to continue. We saw that with mining in the Philippines and further encroachment in the Amazon rainforest. Global Witness cited a Freedom House report that found 158 countries had placed new restrictions on demonstrations due to the pandemic. In some cases, lockdown may even have made matters worse by making it easier for assassins to know where to find their targets and by making campaigners more vulnerable to digital attacks. The pandemic also made it more difficult for Global Witness and its partners to investigate the circumstances of each killing. They found that at least 30% of recorded attacks were linked to resource exploitation, chiefly logging, mining, and hydroelectric dams. But in more than 100 cases, the cause was unclear. The veteran environmental activist Bill McKibben placed the blame on resource exploitation by companies from wealthy nations. In a foreword to the report, he wrote, "Corporations need to be more accountable and they need to take care, take action, especially since the people who inhabit these places never really share in the riches they produce. Colonialism is still running strong, even if it's dressed up with corporate logos or hidden with offshore bank accounts. Meanwhile, the rest of us need to realize that the people killed each year defending their local places are also defending our shared planet, in particular, our climate." Global Witness also reported several notable victories for defenders of the environment in 2020. The Zimbabwe Environmental Law Association and conservation groups halted a plan by two companies to build a coal mine in the Hwange National Park. Environmental activists have slowed tar sands extraction and pressured banks to stop financing exploration in the Arctic region. In South Africa, a high court cancelled approval for a coal-fired power plant in Limpopo province. In Brazil, the Axaninka indigenous community won compensation for illegal deforestation of their territory by a logging company. The watchdog group has outlined proposals for governments and companies to reduce the risks of violence in resource extraction. In future, they put hope on a new bill being drafted by the European Union Commission that would require companies to conduct mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence on their supply chains. The United Nations is also working on a binding treaty on business and human rights, but there is still a long way to go before such measures reduce the impunity that allows the killings to take place.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.